So since it's our twice weekly sitting together, it's the usual time we'll either play a Dhamma talk or I'll reflect on Dhamma. So it's a good opportunity. This monastery, the way we've got it at Santi, is it's set up in a way that really supports a practice in many ways of more mature practitioners, because there's a lot of personal time to cultivate the practice. So we only have the two group meetings a week, and of course our work together in the morning and the lunch time, where we sometimes have a very brief Dhamma reflection as well. But having less structure, as many other monasteries have a bit more structure, having less structure provides a particular opportunity for individuals to cultivate practice more in solitude and cultivate their own structure, if you like, in terms of how to practice, what particular rhythm of practice, meditation, study, contemplation, whether sitting, walking, standing, lying down, developing mindfulness in all postures. This is a really wonderful opportunity that we have here, and certainly doesn't suit everyone. Sometimes some people actually need a bit more structure, and quite often in the early stages of practice, structure, and particularly for junior monastics who haven't had a lot of meditation experience, the structure of a monastery with the community moving in unison, such that I experienced in my early monastic life in England, living at Amravati and at Chithurst, was very structured, and it had its benefits in terms of just letting go of one's own way of doing things and just joining in with the way the community did things. And there was a lot of teaching going on in those days when the community would have morning puja and evening puja every day, and we'd have breakfast together every day, lunch together every day, tea together every day, we'd work together every day. And in those early days, Ajahn Sumedho would be teaching almost every day as well, at breakfast, after breakfast, sometimes at tea times, at least twice a week in the evenings. And I remember as a younger practitioner that I would be hanging out for those teachings, enthralled by them and hanging on to every word to deal with the dukkha that was coming up in my own heart and mind. So this opportunity here is very different, but for me it feels very quite the way how I like it. After many years of moving in a highly structured institutional setting, those who are more senior or more mature in their practice really long for more solitude. So here we have the forest, we have the time, we have the solitude, we have the support of the community with a little bit of structure. So we have this situation to observe ourselves, to observe the mind, which is so much a part of the cultivation of the Buddha's teaching, the cultivation of meditation, of mindfulness, obviously service and generating wholesomeness in body and speech, in action and speech, is a big part of the path as well. But being in meditation monastery, we also have this time alone to really just observe the way our own mind moves. And this can be a very enlightening, thankfully, process, but it can also be a very painful process at times when we come face to face with a habitual patterning of the mind, with a lifetime, however old we are, a lifetime of conditioning. And depending on our particular view, probably we recognize lifetimes of conditioning. So learning how to practice the path, I have found learning is such a deep, ongoing deepening experience in this path. It changes from the inside, really. The teachings, in some sense, remain the same. Many teachers teach differently. Teach even from within the same tradition, not just looking at different traditions, but within the same tradition we have teachers often even in the same lineage who teach very differently. And this is something each of us has to navigate, is in hearing the teachings and learning how to apply the teachings in our practice. Really, we have to learn from the results of our practice to know for ourselves, is this moving in the direction of insight, of lessening suffering and not increasing suffering. This is something we have to see clearly for ourselves. The language, as teachers, the language that's used to teach, these are languages, a convention, and even within the same culture, within the same spoken language tradition, there are so many different conventions of language in different age groups, in different class groups, gender groups, whatever. Words can mean so many different things, even within the same culture, let alone across different cultures and across different generations and time spans. So we're inheriting the Buddha's teachings from over 2,500 years ago in ancient Brahmanic India, a very different time and place to ours. And they've been handed down orally, translated orally, and then written down in different languages, and then translated from those languages into English by people conditioned by other religions. So what are we getting? What are we getting in the end? Something, you know, it's quite marvelous that I think the seeker, the searcher, the practitioner will hear what they need to hear. I guess that's part and parcel of seeking. And we come into contact with the teaching. If something makes sense for us, if something starts to ring the right bells, we'll stay with it, we'll try. If it arouses faith or confidence in us, then we bring forth our energy to put something into practice and to learn from the results. And this is at the essence of the Buddha's teaching anyway. We get this coming out in the teachings from the early texts, that the defining measurement of practice is for each practitioner to see for themselves the results. Is it moving in the right direction? And the whole of the Buddha's teaching is he summed it up in many different ways when he was asked at different times to give a pithy or concise teaching. But of course, all of his teachings are clearly summed up within the Four Noble Truths. And these Four Noble Truths really speak to us as human beings because of all the experiences we have in common. The experience of suffering, whether the merest scent of discontent along to the other end of the spectrum, to the greatest experience of despair or pain. This experience of suffering is actually a central concern to us as human beings. From the moment we can remember, as far back as we can remember in this life, if we look back and examine right up until now, if we look at what moves us in this life, what moves this mind, what motivates us, really is really centered around these experiences of pain and pleasure, and of course the conditioned ideas of who we are and what we're told we should be doing, and what we come to think we should be doing with this life and in this life. But our central concern moves around the experience of suffering. And the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha declaring the essence of what he awoke to, what he awakened to, became the fully enlightened Buddha, was the complete understanding of these Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, or the arising of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So he had thoroughly understood each of these truths. We call them truths, but they're not just one truth that's comprehended in a moment. It's the experience of our life, the arising and ceasing of suffering, and the experiences internal and external that generate more suffering, and there are those experiences internal and external which will move to relieve suffering or to release suffering. So when he said he declared full enlightenment, he said it wasn't until he'd comprehended these truths in their three, each of them had three different aspects. So in their 12 aspects, once he'd fully comprehended that, he declared full enlightenment. So there's a lot of examining going on in his own practice, in his own practice as a seeker, as a striver, and also the understanding that arose through deep insight. He could see clearly into the machinations of this mind, of this experience of being human. So there's three different aspects of each truth. It's quite simple in the sense that these truths are declared as they are, the truth of dukkha, its arising, its ceasing, and the way to realize its ceasing. And the other aspects are what should be done or what needs to be done in relation to each of these truths. The truth of dukkha needs to be understood or comprehended or fathomed or, what's another word to describe it? Apprehended is another way. It needs to be apprehended. This truth of dukkha, as we experience it, in other words, we're talking about don't make a philosophy out of dukkha. Don't just think about dukkha. Apprehend it when it pierces the heart, when it squeezes the heart, when you feel the pain or the burden, whatever that experience of dukkha is. To apprehend it is to bring awareness to it, to wake up to it. Oh, here it is. This is the First Noble Truth. It's happening here. In my own heart, mind, I can see it directly. This is your experience. This is not a teaching from a book to be believed in, a teacher to be followed or believed in. This is your experience. That's what it needs, what you need to awaken to in that aspect of the First Noble Truth. And not only apprehended, but understood. So I'm apprehending this experience of suffering. We don't have to understand it intellectually, but we have to be willing to stay with it enough over our different experiences of suffering to come to understand its manifestation, its arising and ceasing in the heart, mind. Ajahn Sumedho used to say to stand under it, which could be interpreted in different ways, but I think instead of trying to intellectually understand it or analyze it, can we just be with it? Can we just hold it? Can we bring our mindfulness to it and not be submerged by it or overwhelmed by it, but to contemplate it, to allow understanding to arise through contemplation with mindfulness, with wisdom. And the third aspect of that truth, and for each of the others, is when you have fully comprehended that. So dukkha, it needs to be apprehended, or there is the truth of dukkha, it needs to be apprehended or understood, let's say and understood, apprehended and understood. And the third aspect, it has been. When we know it completely, we can have full confidence it has been understood. Each of those truths, the second noble truth is the cause of dukkha. There is a cause, that's the truth. There is a cause for this illness, this disease. And he said what we have to do there, the task, the second aspect is the cause being craving. Craving needs to be abandoned. That's our task there. Dukkha needs to be understood. The cause, craving, needs to be abandoned. And the third aspect of that truth is when we have completed the path and craving has been abandoned. You can look at that as a completion of the path, or you can look at that in a moment of releasing grasping on something. And you taste a moment of cessation of suffering. When the grasping has been released, it could be just a very simple thing. Like I was saying in the meditation, if the thoughts have grabbed your attention and you find yourself thinking about the past or the future, this has a dukkha of its own, this kind of mundane, habitual spin of being caught in thinking. But when you wake up to that, mind's thinking. And then you realize there's this opportunity to release the thought, to release free awareness, free attention from being entrapped in that storyline, for that just that moment, exploring the potential, the possibility to release attention from a concept or a storyline. What does that feel like? How is that possible? This is the territory of the second and the third noble truth. And exploring that in meditation in terms of releasing thinking or abandoning thinking, or abandoning thinking is often generated by desire, habitual desire and aversion, the liking, the disliking, the wanting, the not wanting. This stirs up the mind and energy and feeds the thinking process. So when we reflect on the mind states, what's present in the mind, when we can detect, there's desire. This is no judgment, just detecting, there's desire for something or other, and that's generating this line of thinking and planning. How can I get that? I can see that process now. The state of being caught in that, of being caught in a craving where one can only envisage relief of that disturbance, of that pain of craving by attaining the object of that craving. That's our usual way to find relief. But in contemplation and meditation, we recognize first, oh yeah, there is the craving, there's the desire, there's the object of the desire, and there's the dukkha of that in the moment, being separated from that which is desired, seeing it as a mental construct, seeing it as something that our attention is caught in. Our sense of self is entrapped there for a moment, or many moments, or lifetimes. You know? If we can begin to discern that through recognizing there is dukkha, examining, exploring, investigating the origin of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, there's this movement of craving, usually in the wanting or the not wanting, without blame. This is not to try to destroy the craving when we see it. It's another kind of craving based on ignorance. What we need to do is see the conditioning power of this force in the mind. And meditation gives us the opportunity to observe that with more clarity. When we cultivate some stillness and clarity, we can see these habitual movements of the mind and have the opportunity to investigate them, particularly according to the Four Noble Truths, because this is the footprint which encapsulates all the Buddha's teachings. And with insight into these Four Noble Truths, truly ushers in awakening or any of those stages on the way to awakening. So we need to understand what they are. So here, the cause of suffering, the Buddha tells us, hey, it's craving. We don't have to, you know, try and figure it out on our own. But we have to really have a look at how does that manifest in this mind, in this experience. And for that, we need to observe. We need to be interested and to look, to be the experiment, to be the guinea pig, to be the scientist, to be the lab. We're it, you know. But fortunately, the Buddha's here too. The Dharma's here. The Sangha's here. They're also here. It's all here. So we're in the right place. No matter what you're working with, wherever you are, it's the complete kit. You just have to hone the faculties. Learning to still the mind, learning to look, investigate. And even if you just take these teachings, the Four Noble Truths, really simple, four fingers, not even the need for the thumb. But work it. You have to work it in your meditation, in your contemplation, in your study, in your life, but it will bear fruit. So looking, being willing to look at the movement of craving in the mind, it's perpetual. If there were not craving, there would not be this experience of samsara, there would not be dukkha. But it's so important not to get hung up on thinking this is my problem. Even subtly, this subtle assumption, I've got to eradicate craving, it's the cause of my suffering. And, you know, if taking it to be a me and mine is not the way. But to see it as a conditioned phenomena, a conditioned pattern of this human mind. And there is that ability to observe, and as we observe, we start to learn how mechanisms work. Sometimes if we jump in there and fiddle around too much, getting involved in getting rid of this and trying to do that and developing this and getting rid of that, we're not really sitting back and observing to see clearly how does it work. We're kind of messing around with the experiment. Sometimes we have to get involved, you know, if it means inhibiting a murderous thought in the moment. But you know what I mean. It's about when you have the opportunity to contemplate, be fearless in just looking at your own mind. Because this is the Dharma, this is where we're learning. And so we're observing the movement of craving along the spectrum. You know, desire at one end of the spectrum, aversion at the other end of the spectrum, the gross manifestations of that at the extreme side and the subtle manifestations in the middle. It fuels a movement of the mind. And if we're willing to look at that, understanding, awareness is naturally present, understanding, wisdom comes out of that process. So with the second noble truth, we learn what it is to release attachment to. We learn what craving is, we learn what attachment and clinging is, we see it arise and we explore ways of releasing it. And when we experience the release of that, we experience a third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, the cessation of craving, whether it's momentary or whether it's a bigger insight that leads to something, you know, a significant shift in our perception, or whether it's the final cracking of the egg and one's fully awake, you know, it's still that movement of the second, third noble truth, understanding craving, and discovering what it is to, this word abandoning, to abandon it, to let go, to relinquish, to free it up. This is freeing up the object as much as the subject because they're connected. Yeah. Object, subject arise together. So whether we learn how to release the object of the craving or learn how to release the sense of the one who is craving, you know, that's only a conceptual construct as well. You know, it's just a conditioned construct. So the observing mind, awareness informed by wisdom, can begin to see through these constructs. Mental constructs is it's my preferred, or I do like that kind of interpretation or translation of sankhara. And you know, craving is a big sankhara. But sankhara is like Ajahn Buddhadasa translates it as mental constructions, or there's mental constructions, fabrications, concoctions, Buddhadasa, concoctions. It's the mind that concocts, or the power, the force in the mind that continually concocts things, constructs things, these mental formations. And the particular mental formation of craving is very key. Craving and clinging is very key to, if we understand how that manifests within our own mind, then we have the opportunity to discover that movement of releasing, abandoning, letting go or letting be. Sometimes letting go, letting be, it's two sides of the same movement of abandoning. Mm. So the third noble truth, there is the cessation of suffering. The task there, it needs to be realized directly. So the Buddha can tell you about the noble truth of cessation, and even if you have 200% faith in him and believe him 200%, it won't release you. It's only your direct realization when you find that action of abandoning or release in your own experience with your own conditioned patterning in the mind. Does it change the heart? Does it flower in insight? So this, it must be realized, is the task, is the what needs to be done here. So the truth is, it's possible, suffering can cease. It's a disease with a cure, the Buddha said. So the third noble truth is the alleviation of the disease. To be realized directly, and the third aspect of that is it has been realized, whether that's a moment of insight or whether that's the completion of the path insight, it's fully realized. And of course, the fourth noble truth is the path, the Eightfold Path, classically talked about as the path which, when cultivated, brings about the full cessation of suffering, the complete cessation of suffering. So in this analogy of the disease, the curable disease, the path is the medicine that the doctor prescribes to bring about the cure. So in terms of the Eightfold Noble Path, we can talk about that in different ways. You know, there is the, in one sense, the everyday activity of cultivating wholesomeness and body, speech and mind. This is the sila aspect. Cultivating the meditation, the right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, or some of samadhi. Samadhi being translated as stillness by Ajahn Brahm, which is quite a lovely translation. The stilling of the mind. And also the wisdom aspect being right view, right intention, motivation or thought. Could be any of those, sankhapa. So these are the eight aspects of the path, and it's traditionally taught, it feels like it's something we develop from day to day in an ongoing sense through our life. And with respect to this, this is not untrue. We use it as a framework, as a paradigm for giving direction to our life, something that's wholesome, something that the Buddha said. He talked about the Eightfold Path. He said there is the mundane aspect and the supramundane aspect. And the mundane is this sense of you know, cultivating it through our lives, in a sense, really seeing how we can generate right speech and let go of wrong speech and you know, cultivate the meditation factors. So we're cultivating, we're developing skills, and this has a tremendous effect in our lives. It changes relationships, it changes directions of life, it generates the conditions for the arising of insight through establishing, contemplating right view and learning how to meditate. So this is all very good. Where it becomes a supramundane path is those moments of insight, what we call the path factors. They're really operating together and in one moment can generate profound insight. And I like contemplating the path factors in this sense, and that they're all these path factors, they're graphically depicted like a wheel. When the Buddha gave his first sermon, he set the wheel of Dharma rolling and taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And this Dharma wheel has eight spokes, and now it's rolling. He said it's set rolling, it can't be stopped by anyone. You know, so it's this momentum, something's gathering momentum, and so it does within our own hearts and minds. When we hear the Dharma and something connects and says yes, this wheel gets rolling and we start cultivating aspects, say in the mundane sense. But actually internally what's happening is this energy is moving, these path factors, the Samma aspect of these eight factors, some are samadhi, some are sati, some are ditti, all of this. The Samma aspect, one way of interpreting that word is that these things are all moving together in one direction, in harmony. They move together in one direction. So each of these factors are connected and they're all moving together in the direction of Nibbana. And that is the direction of the allaying of suffering. So if we really contemplate that and look at that in each, or even in one's meditation, in each moment, as we bring the different faculties we've been developing of setting up right view, right intention, meditation, we're in a monastery, the sila's being kind of looked after by our choice to just put ourselves in this container and observe the precepts, and you're sitting down, you're making this right effort to observe what's happening in the mind, to establish mindfulness, develop some stillness. So all of these factors are present in, even as we sit here. And for them to be working together all the time is really generating the power in this path. And so you might think, oh, I'm just sitting down, watching my breath, whatever. But if you think like that, if you believe that, you're kind of stuck in a mundanity. But if you wake up to the kind of bit more of the magic of this mind through recollecting this great mystery and power of awareness itself, of consciousness itself, of being able to comprehend a teaching which shows a way out of suffering, you know, this wakes up the faculties. And just through that establishing right view in that moment, we set up a different level of those path factors. So this is something we can recognize and something we can also work to cultivate in our practice moment by moment. Every moment, you know, there is these path factors developing and turning, and it's all based on right view. If we can recognize that that suffering, its arising, cessation and path is right here in every moment, if we can really wake up to that fact, that profound right view, then all the other path factors come upon that. Who talks about if we establish right view, that's the cause for right intention the cause for the right speech, right action, right livelihood, cause for right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. So it all rests on right view and then it turns. So establishing right view is really important. And right view, simply talked about as the Four Noble Truths, understanding the Four Noble Truths. Also recognizing that they're working within us in every moment, there to be seen, each person for themselves with wisdom. So liberation from suffering is possible here and now, not off in the future. To hold that as part of your right view will keep you connected to the path. If liberation is only ever a future potential, it will always be off in the future that never comes. So bring your practice back to here and now. Everything is happening here and now. The world we construct with our perceptions and thoughts is being constructed in this mind here and now. The past that we construct with our thoughts in the present is just here and now. The future we construct with our thoughts in the present is just here and now. So this is all aspect of right view, to know where we need to practice, where craving arises, where craving ceases, where nibbana is realized here and now. So I think I've talked long enough, so I'll offer these words for our reflection this evening.